Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And thanks for joining us again for another virtual event. And today we're delighted to have Fiona Davis back with us. She's going to be talking about her brand new book, The Spectacular. And she has signed a bunch of books for us. And our copies also come with this very cool insert here.
Yeah. And there's a story behind it that Fiona can tell you about. Who is the woman on the insert?
Her name is Sandy. And when I was starting to think about where to set my next book, I actually got an email through my author website. And it was this woman. She said, I'm in my mid-80s. I'm a former Rockette. And if you want to know the secrets of Radio City Music Hall, you should call me. Now, she knew I set my books in iconic New York City buildings, so I could not resist. And we had this marvelous conversation. At the time, she lived in South Carolina. And she just had all these vivid memories about being a Rockette that were just so interesting. And she spoke with such joy about her time at dancing on that stage, which was from the late 50s to early 60s. And I just thought, you know, there could be a story here.
And there is, which is what we're going to find in The Spectacular. Sorry, Patrick, finish your speech and then we'll take off.
Oh, my speech is just, if you have questions for Fiona, go ahead and put them in the comments or the chat feature here, and I'll be happy to ask any that you might have. So,
and I'm going to put a buy link in the comments.
Yes, here. I'm sorry. I'll put a buy link as well for the signed copies. We don't have very many left, so jump on them.
Right, indeed. Although we probably could get more. So Fiona, I am actually a person who has been to Radio City Music Hall in the time frame of this book. When I was young, I was the oldest granddaughter. And so my grandmother wanted to go to Europe in 1955. And so I was elected to go with her. And we sailed over on the old Queen Mary and came back on the old Queen Elizabeth. That's a potential story for you about the big ships and, you know, and the docks in New York and so forth. But anyway, because we had a couple of days in New York, she took me to the Rainbow Room for lunch, which I have to tell you, in the 1950s, it was like the Stork Club, was one of those really glamorous. I mean, you know, I'm a little girl from suburban Chicago, so I thought it was unbelievably cool to be up there at Rockefeller Center in the Rainbow Room. Unfortunately, we were not able to go and see the Rockettes, but you know, they were also an epitome of glamour in New York. Maybe, I don't know, maybe more for tourists than locals. What do you think?
No, I've heard from so many New Yorkers who say, just like you, one of their early memories is going to Radio City Music Hall or seeing the Rockettes, or and you know, they're just as excited, and they bring back their kids and their grandkids every year.
Wow. Well, I'm sorry that I've never actually seen the Rockettes, but who of us doesn't know about them, and particularly their fabulous Christmas shows, which, you know, are legendary. My husband grew up on Park Avenue, and so I've never asked him. I wonder if he actually has been to one of the Rockette shows.
Yeah, he might have been dragged to one against
kicking. He might. No, I will inquire. I mean, there were a whole lot, especially in the 50s. There was all this sort of glamour and glamour spots to New York, big, you know, for incoming tourists and so forth. And that was a more formal age. I mean, that's when people actually got dressed up to go on airplanes and didn't wear their pajamas. And, you know, you wouldn't have dreamt to going to go out to dinner or to any kind of a formal, not so much a formal, but an evening event. You wouldn't have dreamt of going to the Metropolitan Opera without, speaking of which, I have a thought for you about the Met, but we'll get to that.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it was a different age, and it was a far more formal age. And at that same trip, when we were in Paris, we went to the Folies Bergères, which, of course, you know, I thought was going to be unbelievably sexy and scandalous and all. And it really wasn't. It wasn't like the Moulin Rouge under Toulouse-Lautrec or anything.
Right.
But there again, you know, it was... people weren't nearly as daring, at least publicly. And so you got to see women dancing in scanty costumes and doing stuff and all. It was more unusual, let me put it that way, and more thrilling than today, when you can watch TikTok and who cares?
Oh, no, that's right. That's why it's fun to write about the past, because it was it really was so different. And in fact, speaking of, you know, crossing the ocean, the Radio City was created and built by a guy named S.L. Rothafel, known as Roxy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of the stage, but it's this beautiful stage in this enormous oval, you know, theater. And then there's these proscenium arches that radiate out from the stage, and they're lit in red, yellow, and orange to mimic a sunrise that Roxy saw on a transatlantic crossing. And his idea was to make the theater look like that sunrise that he saw from the ship as he was crossing the ocean.
You can kind of see it in the cover.
Yeah, that's the exterior. And the interior, it's really, really a beautiful, beautiful theater. It's all Art Deco. And yeah, like you said, it's really classy. It's stunning.
I have it on my list when I go to New York next time. All of our travels were interrupted there for so long, but happily everybody is. And I've tried to dodge revenge travel because, you know, it just makes it crowded, but we're starting to travel again.
And
Anyway, so the idea for this story was not, it came to you from a conversation with somebody who actually was a Rockette.
Yeah, and so it was amazing. And so I started digging into the history. And, you know, right now, Radio City is a concert venue. You see bands there, there's a board show, there's comedians. But back then, it was a movie theater. Right. And it showed 4 shows a day. And if you bought a ticket to the movie, you also got a ticket to the stage show that they would show in between. And that would involve the Rockettes. It involved the Radio City Ballet Corps, believe it or not. There was a choral ensemble that would perform, and there was, they'd bring on like jugglers or entertainers. And so it was very different from what it was today. And today, if you're a Rockette, like you said, you do the Christmas show, and that's very seasonal. But back then it was a full-time job, and you danced 4 shows a day for 3 or 4 weeks straight, and then you'd get a week off.
Wow.
And so it was intense. And each performance was kind of connected to the movie that was being shown. So say it was a John Wayne movie, they'd do kind of a cowboy theme. Mm-hmm. And that meant that whenever there was a new movie coming in, and I think there were like 700 premieres at Radio City over the years, including King Kong and White Christmas and MAME. And so if they had a new show coming in, they'd have to learn the new number, which they would do in between the shows that they were already doing, or in the morning or late at night. And so it was this incredibly difficult job. And they had a kick line in every dance number, which meant they did 600 kicks a day, which is a lot. So you had to be in tip-top shape. You had to be the best of the best to be a Rockette.
Yeah, I mean, your physical conditioning would have to be extraordinary. Did they last very long? I mean, that takes a real toll on your body.
You know, I think eventually they might go off and get married or have a family. My book takes place in the 50s. And so that was pretty common, is you do it for a few years and then move on. But these days, you know, there are dancers who've been Rockettes for 10 years and they do it right into their 30s. You know, back then it was really kind of 18 to 23, 25 was the average age of the Rockette.
Well, that makes perfectly good sense, considering the physical conditioning and the stamina that, and also you wouldn't have much of a personal life if that was your work schedule.
Yeah, my friend Sandy, who inspired me, she actually met her husband, Bob, when they were both 19, because he ran the lighting board at Radio City Music Hall, and they've been married ever since.
I love it. Well, you know, there are lots of women who attracted admirers. I mean, that's a very Victorian or sort of thing, you know, where women on stage attracted either husbands or maybe more often lovers who then, you know, supported them and so forth. So yeah, it was, but I've always thought it was more of a young person's game, but then, you know, the age thing has really changed dramatically in mm-hmm. the last couple of decades as people have, you know, paid more attention to aging, you know, more physical conditioning, better diet, you know, the whole bit, not to mention actual rules about age discrimination, which
there's that too.
For employers, you know, it's an interesting thought. I wonder if employers of something like the Rockettes are actually subject to the same discrimination rules as, say, say my bookstore, where, you know, we'd really be smacked if we let somebody go because we thought they'd aged out. Of course, in our case, I'm the oldest member of the team. It's not likely, but it could happen. I mean, it could.
You know, what's so funny is that the Rockettes, just to show how things have changed over time, when the group was formed in 1925, it was actually formed in St. Louis, Missouri. They were called the Missouri Rockettes. Hmm. And the height requirement then was 5'2 to 5'6 and a half. And today it's 5'5 to 5'10 and a half. So it shows you how people have grown over time.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. I remember years and years, well, maybe even on that trip, going to Anne Hathaway's cottage in Shakespeare Country. Yes. And I, who am barely 5 feet two, had to duck under all the doorways because people were so small. In fact, I once saw one of Napoleon's uniforms at Malmaison, Josephine's home outside Paris. And he was like 4'8". He was really tiny, you know, but that wasn't that unusual.
No. I mean, things have changed in terms of health and diet. But what was really funny in terms of learning about this was talking to Rockettes, because I talked to Sandy and then I met more and I spoke with more and more Rockettes. Some had been there in the 40s, some 50s, 60s. Yeah. And they all talked with such kind of energy and joy about what it was like to dance on that stage. Because, you know, as we're talking in the 50s and 40s and 60s, women were supposed to be teachers or nurses or secretaries or wives. And yet here were these women who were living in New York City, making their own money, independent, free. And I remember talking to one and she talked about walking hand in hand with her fellow Rockettes down the middle of Fifth Avenue in the middle of the night, singing at the top of their lungs. You know, there was this kind of amazing independence that could be found there. And you know, it was a real sisterhood. I asked, was there any, you know, backstabbing or anything like that behind the scenes? And they all said, no, it was a real sisterhood in many ways. And that's a real testament to the guy who founded it, named Russell Markert, who, you know, was a really positive, wonderful father figure to all of them. And he retired eventually in 1971. And so it was just fun to learn, you know, fun little gems. Like one Rockette talked about how the last show of the night, the conductor would always speed up so he could make his train home. And so they were left out there just kicking as fast as they could. It was just really, you know, they weren't allowed to get suntans or sunburns if they weren't allowed to gain or lose weight. And it was really about illusion. You know, when you look at them, it looks like they're all the same person, really, with the same lipstick, same hair pullback. But, you know, when they do say the kick line, the tallest girls are in the middle and the shorter ones are at the end, and all the hemlines are the same. And so it gives this illusion of them being all the same person. And the same with when they do the kick line, you know, it looks like their hands are behind each other's backs. But in fact, there's a few inches of distance between the hand of the girl and the back of the girl next to her. And I'm assuming that's so they do, if they wobbled, they wouldn't bring the whole thing down. But it's all about illusion. And it takes such precision and strength and technique to be able to dance that way. And so that's where the kind of the idea for setting the book there came from. And the lead character in the book is called Marion. And she auditions to be a Rockette against the wishes of her father. And she's a wonderful dancer, but she's actually based on an actress named Vera Ellen. Mm-hmm. Who was in White Christmas, because she was a Rockette when she was very young, but she couldn't fit in. Yeah, she could not fit in. If Russell Markert wanted a kick that was shoulder high, hers would be eye height. You know, she just was too, there was too much for her for the stage. And he gave her a couple of weeks to figure it out. And she eventually quit before she was fired and then went on to, you know, great success as an actress. And so my character has a similar issue of she's just bursting with energy and life. And the theme of the book is really, you know, what is the cost of suppressing your own individuality or your own creativity for the good of the common whole, you know, whether it's a dance team or a corporation or the community, you know, when do you work as a team and when do you need to step up and make your voice heard? And so Marion has that kind of comes into that as a individual in the course of the book to figure out kind of how to go on. She's kind of faced with pretty dire circumstances.
She is. You know, most of your books have had a bigger story in the aftermath, so to speak. But in this one, it's almost all in the time that Marion is a Rockette. And there's a bit of a coda, but it's not nearly as significant as in some of your other stories. So Marion has to fight against her father, who is domineering and very old school, and wants her to become engaged to someone that Marion fears will be basically a company man, right? Like a sort of the IBM. And, you know, I remember that. And in the 50s, that was really kind of a dream, you know, is that you'd go from high school or college, whatever it was, and you'd go into a job and you'd stay there. You know, you would rise through the corporate ranks and work towards retirement and all, but it was a very narrowly defined life. And the Rosie the Riveter women who, you know, has worked so hard during World War II, by then, to a great degree, had been relegated back to the sort of Donna Reed, you know, vacuuming a house in your crinoline, you know, and all the rest of it. And women, I don't think women were even allowed to wear pants in public in many. I'm telling you, when I went to Stanford in 1958, we were not allowed to wear pants on campus.
Yeah, I know at the Barbizon Hotel for Women, up until I think the 70s, you weren't allowed to cross the lobby if you were wearing pants. You had to be wearing a skirt.
Yeah, so I mean, that's hard for people to imagine now because it wasn't that long ago. But nonetheless, you know, and that's another question I thought that you brought out well in the book is, where is an independent woman with her own money? Where is she actually going to live in New York City? You can't reasonably, given that schedule, it'd be very hard to commute any big distance, you know, finishing up late at night and who's looking after you. So where did women like that live, career women?
Yeah, you know, that was tricky because, you know, you couldn't get an apartment on your own. You would need a man to co-sign for it. And also, I think a lot of landlords wouldn't want a single female. They would assume the worst and think that you were immoral in some way. It was so different. And so a lot of the women went and stayed at a place called the Rehearsal Club, which was just on 53rd Street. So just a few blocks away from Radio City. And a number of Rockettes lived there. And it was this kind of boarding house for women in the performing arts. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the movie Stage Door with Ginger Rogers and Katherine Hepburn? That's set at that boarding house. And you know, there were a lot of rules. There was no alcohol, no smoking, no boys above the parlor room. You had a midnight curfew. Right. You had to be between 18 and 25 and neither married nor divorced. And you had to be pursuing a career in the performing arts, either taking classes or auditioning or performing. So it was really the perfect place for these Rockettes to stay. And some of the Rockettes who stayed there, or some of the people who stayed there, include Carol Burnett, who, can you imagine rooming with Carol Burnett? That would have been so much fun. Diane Keaton, Sandy Duncan, Blythe Danner. Wow. And yeah, it was this, and it's recently been revitalized. There's kind of a new Rehearsal Club, not in the same location, for women coming to New York and needing a place to stay that's safe and where they're, you know, protected. And back then you got room and board, you got two meals a day during the week for, I think, $18 a week. Quite a bargain.
So that's another thing that's really changed our prices, not to mention the cost of New York real estate. So what's the difference between a hotel like the Barbizon and the Rehearsal Club? Is it based more on, you know, work than it is on private life?
Yeah, you know, the Rehearsal Club, you had to be in the arts. So it was full of people who were, you know, maybe opera singers or dancers or actors. You know, so it was very vibrant. And the Barbizon was much, much bigger because it was a huge skyscraper. So there you got, you know, the Ford models had a couple floors there. The Katie Gibbs Secretarial School would put their students up there. And so it was a similar type of student. It's just that this one was more specialized and much smaller.
Right. No, I mean, that makes perfectly good sense that, you know, they would house them. What was something like that? I mean, here I'm revealing the fact that unlike my husband, I did not grow up on Park Avenue, so I'm sort of ignorant. What was the Chelsea Hotel? What's the difference between that and something like the Barbizon?
Yeah, the Chelsea Hotel was co-ed, so it was open to both men and women. And that was similar. You know, it was a hotel where you could come in and just stay a couple nights. But there were a number of long-term residents who stayed there as if it were the Barbizon Hotel, just, you know, and they lived there for decades even. And that was in a different area. It was down kind of near Chelsea. So it was a little further downtown and a little more arty and quirky with a lot of painters, a lot of political activists. You know, the poet Dylan Thomas you know, drank like 37 whiskeys at the White Horse Tavern and then died at the Chelsea Hotel. So it's full of, you know, crazy ghosts of poets and things. So it was just a little more, a little less regulated, I would say. It was a bit of a free for all to Chelsea in a good way.
Right. But I knew part of it was residential. Actually, as I understand it, you could be residential at the Plaza. You know, I don't know if you can still do it, but for certainly for a long time, possibly yeah. before Trump, you know, you could actually live at the Plaza. I mean, now hotels are doing that, but what they're doing is they're largely creating standalone, you know, villas and stuff so that you can, we have a Ritz-Carlton going in here.
Right, so there's one area in the condo and yes.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. The Ballyho near the bookstore where so many authors stay when they come to see us has a condo complex, you know, attached to the hotel. So I guess the idea is that you get the benefit of hotel services, but you have a private quarters. So you're not in the exactly. hotel.
Yeah.
And I think you have to buy them, although I might be wrong. I'm not sure maybe you can rent them, but I think a lot of them are actually for sale.
Yeah, I know the Chelsea reopened after a long renovation, and about 40 of the longtime residents still live there. But I think that is still just rental. You know, I don't think they bought their apartments. It's still rental, and it's beautiful. If anyone ever wants to stop by, it's really, really gorgeous and beautifully done, and they kept the original details in a great way. So that's kind of exciting. The Barbizon, of course, now is all condo. Yeah, well, there's on the fourth floor, there were about a dozen of the old time residents who were kind of moved into studios with kitchenettes, but I'm not sure how many of those are left.
Wow. Well, you know, different living models for different eras and so forth. Yeah. So yeah. It's really fun to read about what it takes to be a Rockette, the rehearsal time, the dedication, you know, the lifestyle, living in the with other women. I mean, it's sort of like a sorority house in a lot of ways, except, you know,
yeah,
for the arts. But as you point out, it's really also about a woman in a time of fair amount of restriction still trying to battle her way out of the expectations of father and fiance. And her own, I'm trying to remember, doesn't she have a sister who is a lot more conventional?
Yes, her sister's a secretary. Yes, exactly. Right.
So mm-hmm. it's, you know, family expectations. How far do you want to alienate yourself from your family? But how much are you going to let your family dictate who you are? Megan Abbott's new book, you might not have read it.
Not yet, no.
Beware of the Woman. It asks two really interesting questions, which I think Miriam is addressing. One of which is, you know, do you really know the person you married or may marry? And she has to think about that. But the other critical question is, you know, what does a child owe a parent?
Mm-hmm.
And how much does what a child owes a parent have, what kind of effect does that have on the child's other relationships? In other words, if you're married, you know, what do you owe your in-laws or your, or your other family members, not necessarily in-laws, but what would you owe your own aunt and uncle or cousins or parents? And how much would that interfere with the dynamics of your marriage? I think COVID probably really tested that, don't you think, when people had to all of a sudden sort of merge together as family units where they yeah. had been separate before?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And, you know, I think in the book, at least with Marion, she definitely has that conundrum with her own father.
Right.
You know, down as things kind of progress in the book, you know, what do you, should you take care of someone who may have betrayed you? How, you know, what do you owe them? I think that is such a good question. And I think something that everybody grapples with, especially as your parents' age and need taken care of, for sure.
Where's her mother in all this?
Mary's mother in the book has passed away.
Right.
So she, that's another issue is, you know, who was her mother? And that's something that she discovers over the course of the book. Who was this woman? And does she want to emulate her? Or does she not want to avoid emulating her? You know, and secrets get revealed about the family dynamic that she didn't know previously. And that really affects her because she meets a man named Peter during the course of the book. as they're kind of hunting, it's a bit of a thriller as they're trying to figure out who's been setting bombs off in New York City, believe it or not, based on a true bomber. And so, you know, she has to decide in this relationship that she might want to undertake, what is her role and will she give up her independence? And, you know, again, what does she owe the person she's with?
Absolutely. I was going to bring up the bomber because there is a, I mean, in all of your books, you're really focusing on the land, you know, whatever the New York City landmark is. My friend Linda Fairstein did so well, you know, previously writing about, you know, but there's almost an infinite number. In fact, there's a new one that cropped up. If you looked at this new, the recently renovated, I think it's Hispanic, I can't remember the name of it. It was all over the Times and the Wall Street Journal a week or two ago. It's a Hispanic North, the city, this beautiful museum and amazing artwork. And
I'll have to check that out. Okay.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely do. It's like the, I can't remember what it's called, the Hispanic, it's a Huntington.
Okay.
One of the Huntington heirs had this great, his focus was on Latin American art and other things. And he built this gorgeous place up there. There are other cultural institutions connected with it and to store his art. And now it's all been renovated, although some of them have moved on to other locations. But yeah, definitely look for it because I thought it was tailor-made for you.
Yeah, oh, it sounds like it. And yeah, you know, I'm always looking for these iconic buildings. And the fun thing about Radio City was, again, looking at how it's changed over time, because around the theater are seven floors of, you know, in the heyday, when there were all these people working on that stage all the time, you had things like, you know, dressing rooms and rehearsal halls. There was a cafeteria. There was a lounge. There was a dormitory, 26-bed dormitory for when the girls wanted to stay overnight. You know, they had a movie premiere room where they could catch early shows. There was like a poster department, a hat and shoe department. And then up on the roof, they would play wiffle ball and shuffleboard. And they would go up there all the time, you know, in between shows, much to the delight of all the workers in the skyscrapers nearby who, you know, loved watching them go on up there and goof around. And it just was this, you know, really marvelous building. And I was in it, you know, recently. And it's like a maze. It's just this incredible space, but it's very different now. One of the few things that's left is the Roxy apartment, which was not an apartment, but an entertainment room for entertaining celebrities who came. And it has a guest book with everybody's names in it, like Walt Disney or, you know, Judy Garland. And it had these 20-foot high gold leaf ceiling and cherry paneled walls, just art deco to the max. And it's really, really stunning. I mean, behind the scenes is as beautiful as the lobby and the theater itself. It's gorgeous.
Wow. Well, there's Carnegie Hall. There's the old Met.
Yeah. Oh.
Metropolitan Opera. They had moved to Lincoln Center by the time I could start commuting to New York to go to the opera, which I have done forever. In fact, the last time I was in New York, I paid something like $400 for a ticket to see, what was it I went to see? It was an amazing performance with Sandra Rafkowski.
Wow.
I know, but it was the only seat left, you know, so that's what it was. But I remember all the hoopla when the new Met opened, but I've always been sad not to have gone to the old one. And Carnegie Hall, if I remember right, has had a very strong renovation.
Yeah, a very big one. And that's an interesting book. I wrote a short story set at Carnegie Hall called A Wild Rose. Mm-hmm. And because as my research, I learned that there, when they built it, there were two floors of artist studios on the very top.
Right.
Where, you know, Marlon Brando lived there for a while. All these people came and went. And I thought that would be a perfect setting for a book, for sure.
Yeah, it absolutely were. If you wanted to be literary, the old Scribner building. I don't know if you remember how gorgeous it was. You went in and it had that beautiful balcony with the wrought iron work. Now I'm not even sure that exists. But I mean, that was a for sure glamour spot, was to stop there. And oh, Lord, it was so. Yeah, time moves on. And unfortunately, urban renewal is a constant thing, isn't it?
It sure is. And, you know, you'd mentioned earlier about I'm known for kind of the dual timeline novels. And this is more like you said, in one timeline, just because I wanted to give myself a little bit of a challenge. And it is a bit more of a thriller. It's got romance and glamour, but there is this thriller element to it. And it just made sense to keep it mostly in 1956 with a few chapters set in 94 or 92 that's about a Rockette looking back on her life, just to kind of pull the story together. But that was a kind of a really fun challenge to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a big story. So I don't know that you could have, I mean, I'm not sure we're going to write like a 400-page tome. Yeah, but why not? You know, why not change up your book some? Do you think that you are, you know, pretty much, I don't want to say tight because that's so unfair. Do you think your readers' expectations are that you are going to write a book that is going to be looking at historical landmarks with some kind of a, you know, thread pulling it forward? I mean, your library book, I thought was fascinating. I had no idea that the NYPL actually had a residential department inside, apartment inside, yeah. For example. You know, the Frick is undergoing renovation. So, you know, it's, I don't think they're changing the interior though, are they? I thought they were just sort of cleaning it up.
They're adding the second floor will be open to the public, which is wonderful. Cool. Yeah, it'll be great. And then they're adding in some more space kind of off to the side and to the back of it, which they needed for educational programs and, you know, book talks and exhibitions. Sure. I think it's going to be really wonderful. I'm excited to see it when they.
I am too. I wanted to go and see the artwork in the Brutalist building on Madison. I really wanted to go to Thrillerfest, but my husband had difficult surgery and I couldn't leave him. I was all set to do that. But, you know, there's the old Museum of Modern Art. And then my sister actually was responsible for the new one before she died. She was the assistant director of MoMA and, you know, put all that together. And then there's the Morgan Library, which, of course, has phenomenal history. Although, you know, there's been at least one fairly recent book about Belle da Costa Green that Marie Benedict.
Yeah, Personal did. Librarian by Victoria Christopher Marie and Marie Benedict is a fantastic book.
It is. Yeah. It's a wonderful book, but there, you know, that's a specific and real person, but that doesn't mean that there isn't opportunities to do something with Morgan. I mean, he was a very colorful figure.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. To say the least. And in fact, the next book that I'm working on now, because of course there's a lag time between turning a book in and it coming out, is actually set at the Met Museum.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So I just got back from a trip to Egypt to do some research, which was quite something. And so it's set in the museum in the 1970s from the point of view of an associate curator and then an assistant to the Met Gala, which is that big party of the year that they do every year. And that was under Diana Vreeland, who was
I remember all that. She used to have the soles of her shoes polished every day after she wore them. So was that the Temple of Dendur? Are you bringing that in? I have been to Egypt 3 times.
Yes. You know, right. We were talking about that.
Yeah, because we could do a whole slideshow thing.
I know you have some remarkable photos. It's just amazing seeing how old everything is. And so my character, who's the curator, it's set partly in the 1930s when she was an archaeologist there, and then partly in the 70s. And it's about the two of these very different people teaming up to find a stolen artifact. And it's been so much fun to work on.
I enjoy it. Yep, heist novels are just so much fun, but the whole Egypt thing is just remarkable. And you know, your timing is good because if we're lucky, they might finally finish the new Egyptian Museum out in Giza, because I have spent a day and a half or 2 days in the old Egyptian Museum, which is right off Tahrir Square, and which had possibly the worst lighting for a museum I have ever seen. And
So crowded and dusty,
but I mean, it's an old Victorian building. It probably was not quite so bad, and people's expectations were different when it opened. But last time I was in Giza, sipping my coffee and watching the sunrise and the pyramids coming into shape, there was all kinds of construction because it's right up the road from the meeting house. And they recently, but there are two things. This is where it gets complicated, because they moved the royal mummies and so forth to one museum. It's not the same museum. And then I'm not sure what they're doing with the ship right by the Great Pyramid, because the ship is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they're going to incorporate it into this new museum or not. But I mean, you know, the whole thing in the artwork, the world, this whole question about whether countries can actually take care. You know, it's the Elgin Marble question, it's the whole bit. And certainly would have been true of Egypt. And it's not true of Egypt's finances are so rocky. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have to ask yourself how much damage could actually happen, you know, and does, does the native thing trump the all the questions about
preservation
and preservation
and yeah, the Met's been going through a huge overhaul about that very ideas to, you know, what do these objects, who do they belong to, the country where they came from or the Met, you know, even if they were acquired legally, but a number of them were acquired illegally. And so they do need to be returned. So it's a real tough question in the art world for sure.
It's a big tough question, you know, the whole colonial, you know, recovering from colonial stuff, but you do have to worry that some of these treasures, I mean, you know, the whole bit about the Russian oligarch that bought whatever the legendary, was it a Da Vinci, and he's keeping it on his yacht, you know, which is like the worst place in the world to keep an ancient oil painting.
All those art historians are going mad, I'm sure. Yeah. But you know, the idea for setting a book at the Met, and again, this is a book that's coming down the road, was from reading an article in the New York Times about at one Met Gala, Kim Kardashian wore this all gold dress and she stood next to this sarcophagus because it was all gold as well. And then the person who stole that sarcophagus complained to an undercover cop in Egypt about how he stole it and that's not fair. He never got paid. And so they were able to track it down and realize that it was acquired illegally. The stamps were all, you know, forged. And in fact, this guy had stolen the mummy, stolen the sarcophagus, dumped the mummy in the Nile, and then sold this to, you know, the underground market where it ended up at the Met. And this was all from an Instagram photo of Kim Kardashian because she's so famous. But it kind of goes to the question you're saying of, okay, how do we keep track of what's, you know, who's going to take better care of things and where do they really belong?
Yeah. And if a guy, you know, was able to steal a sarcophagus and dump a mummy, you know, and all the rest of it, what kind of security or what kind of custodial? I remember, you know, being in the Hermitage and it's right along the banks of the River Neva and so forth. And the windows, it was a hot summer day and the windows were open and the dust is blowing in and all right across the whichever Da Vinci it is, Girl of the Ermine or something like that, you know, and so there are questions. And some of these old buildings that, you know, have become museums or hold these great collections, but were never built to really do a great job with that. You know, the Met is upgraded and upgraded and upgraded. And, you know, we know so much more now about conservation than we once did, but it's amazing to me how much stuff has survived. You know, in adverse conditions. And
when you see, like, there's that painting in Spain, I think, where there was this very, like, from the Middle Ages, this painting of Christ in the church, and they took it and to fix it up, and it turned out it just completely contorted the face on it, and it ended up just looking just laughable, you know, because whoever did that job was not qualified. It's just awful to see. But it was fun in the book, in the spectacular, you know, speaking of heists and things, is to bring in this thriller element. Because when I was doing research into the 1950s in New York, where the book is set, I learned that this guy called the Mad Bomber had set bombs for 16 years all over New York City in iconic buildings like Grand Central or Penn Station, even the New York Public Library. And he set 33 bombs over 16 years. And he injured 15 people, some very seriously. And the police just couldn't find him. And so 1956, when the book takes place, is right when the police were ramping up the search for this guy. And to do that, they reached out to a psychiatrist and asked him to read the letters that they'd been sent over the years. And it was the first instance of criminal profiling ever. Hmm. And the guy they asked to look at it was this psychiatrist named James Prussell. And he read all these letters and he said, he came up with this list. He said, it'll be 40 to 50, very methodical, not married, living with an older female relative. He'll be from Eastern Europe, Roman Catholic, more and more, all these things. And he said, finally, when you catch him, he'll be wearing a double-breasted suit and it will be buttoned. And needless to say, without giving anything away, the science of criminal profiling was born from this guy. And so I love that concept. So in my book, when I learned that the Mad Bomber hit Radio City Music Hall twice with bombs, I thought, okay, I can weave this into my story. So for very personal reasons, Marion gets caught up in the hunt for the Mad Bomber. And she teams up with a brilliant and kind of introverted psychiatrist named Peter to hunt the guy down. And so I've changed some things in the book. For example, in the book, he's called the Big Apple Bomber. I had to change some things just to make the story fit. And I explain it really well in the author's note, kind of what's fact and what's fiction. But what's amazing is how much is fact. And to just pull from these things that really happened and kind of add them to the scaffolding of the story, it was so much fun.
But did you like the thriller elements?
Yeah.
Yeah, you did. Mm-hmm. Right. So are you tempted to incorporate more of them into your stories now that you've, kind of stuck your toe in?
You know, maybe a little bit, but not too much. You know, it's fun to just kind of play around with the format and the formula and to kind of incorporate things just so I don't get bored. So, you know, every book has a new challenge for me, which has been so much fun. So I think there might be a little bit, but this was pretty, you know, the hunt, and like, it was fun to do a chase scene through Radio City Music Hall late at night. That kind of thing was just a hoot.
They're different kinds of thrills, or crime novels. For example, a heist novel is dramatically different than, you know, a serial killer or hunt for a bomber. They're all kinds of crimes, fraud and so forth, you know, so you can generate extra suspense without getting into a rut.
Yes, sure. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I know you're having a wonderful time doing this. What inspired you to take on the idea of landmarks in the first place?
You know, it wasn't something I consciously did. I wrote the first book about the Barbizon Hotel for women just because I thought that would be an interesting book. And then when that was done, I was walking by the Dakota and thought, oh, that could be a really fun building to try and get into and to set a book there. And then I just realized, oh, this is a thing. And readers seem to like it. And I like snooping around old buildings, so it's fine with me. And then suddenly that is kind of the landmark series was born, but it really wasn't a conscious thing. And I didn't think, well, no one's done this before, I'll do this. It really was just, this is what I like to do. And I love old buildings and there's a story in every one.
Absolutely true. And of course you live in Manhattan too. So, you know, in New York City, which gives you ample opportunity. It'd be a lot harder to write your books in Phoenix, which is such a modern city. We don't have a huge number of old buildings. Maybe it'd be interesting at some point, you know, to do an architect, and you could even kind of do a link to some, because some of these architects built things in New York, but in other places as well. Certainly Chicago has this phenomenal architecture, and I think some of them probably also operated in New York. That might be a fun thing to do sometime.
That would be really fun, especially because that kind of Gilded Age 1920s, 1930s architecture, those eras are really interesting. And the architects at the time were stars, you know.
Had lives like Frank Lloyd Wright, for example, which is, you know, a thriller all by itself. No, I mean, you know, it also, you know, America was really changing a lot. You know, the First World War brought it much more into the global stage. Second World War certainly did, and many things reflect that, you know, we moved from a much more agrarian and much more internal society. And so other influences, I mean, why is Washington, for example, more or less, you know, Federalist style or Greek buildings, or why are so many of our buildings classical when they could instead, you know, be like the Prairie architecture? So there's a lot to work with in there.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Oh, I find it fascinating. Yep.
I do too. All right, Patrick, come and join us and see if we have any questions from the audience so that Fiona can make her deadline.
Okay. Yeah, there are some good questions here and some nice comments. Susan says, that is awesome that there was that level of love and support among the Rockettes rather than the element of competition. Similar to how many of the authors in the book community are so supportive of each other's books and publication and tour dates, which is nice. Her question is, let's see here. During the time period that this book takes place in, did the Rockettes share living spaces during their working years, or did they live all over the city?
Yeah, you know, some, if they lived nearby, would commute from their family homes. Some lived together in apartments or in, for example, the rehearsal club. Some bunked up together because that was easiest. It was a real mix of where they ended up doing and what they ended up, you know, staying at. And there were options in New York, and some lived in the Barbizon Hotel, which is kind of cool.
Let's see, you may have addressed some of this, but did you know the history of the Mad Bomber before you started research for this book, or did you uncover it while researching?
Yeah, that's a great question. I had never heard of him, and no one I know has heard of him. There's maybe one person I've met who's in their 80s who lived in New York who nodded their head when I kind of mentioned it in passing. It's amazing how he just kind of was forgotten after he was caught. And it was a big deal when he was caught. It was in all the papers, you know, and the papers covered the hunt for him like crazy. And so, yeah, I'd never heard of it. And what I did was I was looking through the New York Times from the 1950s and just scanning headlines and, you know, getting a sense of what that time period was like. And that jumped out to me. It said that they caught the Mad Bomber in January of 1957. And I thought, the Mad Bomber, you know, who's that? And went down a rabbit hole and thought, okay, he's going to be in the book.
So was the profile correct when they caught him?
Exactly. Really? And the police at first were very kind of skeptical, as you can imagine, because no one had ever done that before. It was just unheard of. And the guy who did it, James Brussel, in real life, went on to teach all over the country and kind of, you know, spread it to the FBI and all over the place. But it started here in New York.
Wow.
There are a couple of fun comments about. Well, one of them, Robin says, I graduated in 1975 and we still had dress codes for both sexes. Our skirts could only be 6 inches above our knees when kneeling. That changed to our fingertip while standing. Guys had limits on their hair length and facial hair designs. And then another lady chimes in with, I graduated in 1973. My yearbook shows the guys with no restrictions on hair length or facial hair. LOL, but the girls had to follow the dress code.
Yeah, isn't that, it's so incredible. I think even the Rockettes at a certain point couldn't wear pants in the theater. They had to, you know, so if they were hungry and someone was wearing pants, the one wearing the skirt would run out to get the food.
Let's see. Did any Rockettes also dance as Jackie Gleason's June Taylor dancers?
Oh, I've never heard of that. Not that I know of. That's so interesting.
It's possible. I mean, yeah. That she might have recruited them because it wasn't so arduous. Maybe Rockettes who, you know, needed a slower pace might have joined another dance troupe like that.
Sure.
Yeah. June Taylor dancers. Wow, I'd forgotten all about that.
Love this. There's another one I can go find out about. That's great.
Yeah.
Over on YouTube here, Nancy makes the point. She says there are still historic women-only dorms in New York City, like the Markle in West Village and St. Agnes in UWS.
Yeah, there's one. St. Agnes is just here. I'm on the Upper West Side, and it's just a few blocks away. And then again, if you Google the Rehearsal Club, you'll come upon a website of the new Rehearsal Club that they've created. It's on West 34th Street. And it's just wonderful. The New York Times did a huge article about it just barely a month ago. And again, it's a space where women can go and get a great apartment and not have to spend too much money. I think they have to audition to get in though.
Wow, now that is an interesting wrinkle. I love that. I mean, rents being what they are in New York, if you could dance or whatever, sing your way into it, how wonderful.
Oh yeah.
Let's see here. Emma asks, so excited to read this. I've loved all your books. Do you think you'll use the primarily one narrator format again or return to dual timelines? And then she says, also, are there any landmarks on the horizon after the Met?
The Met will be more dual timeline and two points of view again. So a little change to that, not exactly the way it has been in the past, but it will incorporate those. And I don't think too far ahead, which is why when I get an email saying, you should look at Radio City Music Hall, I'm pretty much up for it, because I don't have a list that I, keep of places. It tends to be the minute I'm done with one book, I just start looking around and something falls into my lap, so far, knock on wood. I there's so many places here in New York. I joke around that by the 18th book, I'll be doing the gas station on the corner of 11th Avenue or something. But I also think it'd be fun to go to London and do a book there and, write off a trip to London. And because, talk about old buildings, right? There you could really find something.
You know what? You could do the cloisters and you could trace every one of those structures that Rockefeller brought over to create the cloisters. You could trace it back in its home country.
There's a wonderful book that just came out last year called The Cloisters by, I think her name's Katie Hayes.
Right.
And it's wonderful. Yeah. So that she's kind of covered the cloisters, but it was a very different kind of book.
It was a different book. Yeah. I mean, I personally think the cloisters is worth several books.
I love the idea of taking the original buildings, right? And starting it there. I think that's a great idea.
Absolutely. Not only that, but Fort Tryon Park is really a fascinating place too, up on the block, and the elevator, going up from the subway up to, or the train, up, that's worth a, I mean, there's a lot of great stuff up there. Oh, so,
yeah. I won't run out anytime soon.
No.
Let's see, anything else here? Mm-hmm. Well, question, what books have you read and enjoyed lately?
Oh yeah, sure. So I just finished a book called Hedge by Jane DeLury. That was just published on Zibby Books. What's that?
Gardens.
Yes. And it's about a garden historian. Mm-hmm. So of course you can see why I like that. And it's a domestic drama, just beautifully written and a really gripping book. And then Wendy Walker is a thriller writer and she has a book out tomorrow called What Remains. And that's a really fun, fast-paced thriller, which I enjoyed. And then in terms of historical fiction, there's a book coming out by Nicola Harrison called Hotel Laguna, the Laguna Hotel. And it's about, California and set in the 50s. It's just, again, and it's post-World War II, what do women do now that the war is over? What should they do? Having, worked and had fulfilling careers. And so it addresses what you were talking about earlier, which is very, very good.
Yeah, that was a hard transition. Wendy Walker will be live at the Poison Pen on Wednesday night at 7 o'clock with Allison Galen, who's taking over the Robert Parker Sonny Randall series. So it'll be, I think, Patrick, I'm right. Isn't this Wendy's first actual visit to the bookstore? I think it is.
I thought she was here once before, but I may be wrong.
Maybe. Or maybe, I'm not always there, so possibly I've forgotten. But well, how about that? I'm glad you enjoyed the book. I thought it was really interesting. It'll be fun to compare it to the Sonny Randall. Anyway, Fiona needs to depart for another engagement. So once again, the spectacular. And once again, we do have this very cool insert with the woman who fired it. And look at her there dancing. I mean, yeah. I love it. It's so great. And then what's the back, Patrick? Right. There's some other material there. So I love the fact that we can offer you something a little more exciting.
Thank you for the partnership. It's just been wonderful. And thank you for everything you've done to support the book.
It's a pleasure. We might need to actually send you more books. I'll let you know because we're running down. But fortunately, it's a renewable resource, as is the insert. So next year, Egypt. I can hardly wait. Egypt and the Met. Oh.
Yes, wow. We are going to have it. We'll have to reserve a couple hours.
We're definitely going to have to do that. All right. Well, thank you very much, Fiona. Enjoy the rest of your publication week. And thank you all for joining us today. Bye.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.